Just after 2 o'clock and time for The Narrow Path with your host, Steve Gregg, on True Talk 800.
Portions of the following show may be pre-recorded.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls if you want to call in with any questions you might have about the Bible or the Christian faith, or if you want to call in with any disagreements you might have with the host. We'd be glad to talk to you about those as well. The number to call is 844-484-5737. And if you're thinking about calling in, but not sure if you're going to do it right now, I'll just say this may be the best time of the whole hour to call in because we have a couple of lines open. No guarantees about the rest of the hour. It often fills up. So the number is 844-484-5737. I want to remind you, we have once a month on a Wednesday night, the first Wednesday of every month, in the evening, a Zoom meeting. It's usually a Q&A. Sometimes it's a Bible study. I think it's a Q&A this time. I do what I'm told. But it's hosted by some Christians, actually in Portland, Oregon, but it's joined by people all over the world. So you're welcome to join us. It's about an hour and a half of Q&A, starting at 7 o'clock Pacific time in the evening. And you can get information about that. You can even get the login information to log in on Zoom by going to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and looking under the tab that says Announcements. And then again, I want you to know that I'm speaking in Texas in about a week and a half. I'll be speaking a couple times at least in the Dallas area and a few times in the Houston area and once in the Spring Branch area, which is up closer, I think, to San Antonio. Anyway, those things are happening, and those are all listed at our website, thenarrowpath.com, under the tab that says Announcements. And so we'll go directly to the phones then and talk to Grace from Pennsylvania. Hi, Grace. Welcome. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Mr. Gregg. I'm a sophomore, and I have a question about evangelism.
Sure.
I want to share my faith, but I also don't want to turn people off to the gospel and cause them to, like, block up their ears to people who are trying to tell them about Jesus. I mean, I don't care what they think of me, but I don't want them to become offended and feel pressured, and then that causes them to harden against Jesus, if that makes sense. I just don't want them to dislike Jesus because of something that I said when it wasn't really, you know, Jesus at all.
Yeah. Well, are you talking about just approaching people to share the gospel, or just talking about Jesus when the subject naturally comes up? What's your normal style in this area, or what you're seeking to do?
I would probably say a little of both. I mean, if the subject comes up, I would definitely talk about it, but I would also be willing to approach people if I know them, mm-hmm. or even if I don't, to talk to them.
Okay. Well, first of all, I can appreciate the fact that you don't want to say things that would turn them off, although I have to say there are more and more things that Christians believe that turn people off today, because the society is going so anti-Christian that to take almost any stance on morality that resembles Christianity is going to put you at odds with somebody, maybe with many people, and not all people are reasonable. That is to say, not all people would say, well, Grace has a different opinion than we do about this. We should listen to what she has to say, and if we're not convinced, we'll just not be convinced. In more cases than used to be the case, I think, people who don't agree with you will want you to be silent. They'll hate you. They will call you a hater. In other words, it's very, very hard to take a stand for Christ without offending somebody these days. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't take a stand and take the risk of offending them when that's necessary. But you said something that sounds very good. You said you don't care how they feel about you. But actually, in many respects, the way they feel about you will have a lot to do with their receptivity to what you have to say. If you say, I don't care what they say about me, and what I mean by that is if people think I'm a fool because I speak up for the truth, well, I'm not looking out for my own reputation in that sense. So that's fine. I mean, that's good. You should be willing to look like the fool for Jesus. But there is also something to be said for, the way they view you having something to do with the degree to which they're likely to take offense or not take offense by what you have to say and the way you say it. What I mean is if they know you, not only as the girl who talks about Jesus, but the girl who is kind and loving and reasonable, intelligent, amicable, sympathetic, generous. I mean, these are Christian traits. If they see this Christ's character in you, this definitely smooths the path for anything you might want to say to them. Now, even if you are perfectly wonderful as a Christian witness in your life, that doesn't mean they won't hate you when you tell them the truth. I mean, think of Stephen in the Bible. He apparently was a great spirit-filled Christian and a very impressive man, but when he told the Sanhedrin what they didn't want to hear, they stoned him to death. So no matter how wonderful you are, that's not a guarantee that people won't hate you when you speak the truth. But they will certainly be more likely to hate you if they don't have a good opinion of you in general. And by in general, I mean quite apart from anything you say about Christ. There are people who, let's put it this way. If you ever say anything about Jesus or stand for Jesus on an issue that they don't agree with, there's always a chance they're going to say you're a hater, you're judgmental, you're a hypocrite. Those are the kind of things unbelievers like to say about Christians. And the best thing that can happen is if they have no grounds at all to say any such things, if even the thought of saying those things about you would make them feel ridiculous, since you're just the opposite of those things. And so I would say this. Sometimes Christians, I know when I was in high school, I witnessed to people a lot. That was during the Jesus movement, and there were a lot more people who were receptive to hearing the gospel among young people than there seem to be now, at least my observation. I don't know as many young people these days. But my impression is that a lot of kids are just really, they're kind of swept away with radical gender theory and the whole propaganda about white supremacy and things like that being, and then they want to, criticize Christians for that for some reason. But I would just say what you need to do is make sure that you, when you speak with grace and you speak truthfully. You don't have to convince them with your words. I've often told unbelievers when I've been talking to them that I don't have to require them to believe, but I am required to let them know why they should believe. I should let them know why I believe and why I think they should, but it's not my place to make them believe. That's still up to them. You need to make it very clear that you can't force them, and you're not trying to force them to become believers. Because if you did force them to become believers, then they aren't really surrendered. They're just surrendered to force. I think that if you're the kind of person that everyone who knows you sees you as honest and generous and humble and kind, then when you speak, they're more likely to say, well, I don't necessarily like what she's saying, but I can't deny that she's got credibility, because just her whole life emanates credibility. And I believe that even in the early church, in the book of Acts, You know, it says the 12 apostles were out witnessing to the resurrection of Jesus, but most Christians were not. Most Christians, like 3,000 of them, were meeting together, fellowshipping together, living their lives as a consistent Christian witness to the world around them, and the apostles did most of the preaching. And yet when the apostles preached, their words were spoken, as it were, from the platform of the witness of the Christian community, which was a group of people whose lives were quite impressive, quite changed, quite good. I mean, the Bible says they had favor with all the people. What, not the apostles, the Christian church itself. The Christians themselves lived in such a way. They're sharing their goods. They're living honest lives. They're doing the right thing. They're being faithful and loving people. And they had favor, such favor as is hard to deny to people who are frankly so impressively godlike. The more you are like Jesus in your character, in your love, and your graciousness to people, your name is Grace, and the more you exhibit grace in your life, the more you're going to impact people on occasions when you do speak to them, and even on occasions when you may not have the opportunity to speak to them. Now, some people are gifted evangelists. I've known some, and they can just kind of walk up into a situation and start a conversation about Christ with an unbeliever, and it seems natural. I mean, the unbeliever doesn't think, what's this weirdo doing here? I mean, it seems very directed by the Holy Spirit. Other people, like me, are not like that. I just can't walk up to a stranger and start talking about the Lord without it seeming contrived, like I'm invading their space or something like that. I'm much better at talking to people about the Lord when it comes up naturally, when there's some issue they're coping with or they're wondering about. And then I can sort of speak to it from the Christian vantage point, and then that, of course, morphs into an opportunity to witness. But the desire to, you know, share the gospel with your friends is a very commendable thing, and you should do it as God opens the doors. But you don't have to feel nervously that if a day goes by and you haven't been able to talk to someone about the Lord because it didn't come up, or because, you know, it just, there was no natural situation for it, or because you haven't, in their mind, as it were, earned the right to speak to them about, you know, personal matters in their lives. You shouldn't feel ashamed that that didn't happen. It doesn't always happen. But I think the more you live consistently as a Christian and as Christ-like, the more it's going to be natural for people to ask you why you don't do what other people do, why you have a different attitude than others have, and opportunities to share the Lord will come up that way. Now, I don't know you. You might be a gifted evangelist. You might be the kind of person who can walk up cold to an unbeliever and just start talking about the Lord, and it just flows, and it's anointed, and God uses it. I don't know very many people like that, but I know some. And I don't know if that's you or not, but I would say, whether you are or not, living your life to exhibit an alternative way of life to that which all the unbelievers are living is more powerful than you might think. It might bring resentment, because people are often convicted if they are wanting to live a sinful life and they're around somebody who doesn't do it. It suddenly makes them look bad because you're not cooperating with them. Peter said that in 1 Peter chapter 4. He said the time is, we've spent enough of our time doing the will of the pagans when we walked like they did. He says they think it's strange that you don't run with them to the same behaviors anymore, and they speak evil of you. Yeah, they think it's strange that you're not living like them, because by not doing so, you're implicitly, without words, saying that the way they're living is something you don't approve of, or else you'd do it too. And the very fact of your disapproval is often, you know, makes them angry. So yeah. There's no way I can tell you how to speak or act that will not bring opposition. Standing for Jesus is likely to bring opposition in the modern world. But on the other hand, speaking isn't the only way you can have an impact.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Grace, and God bless you. And hope you're successful. All right, bye now.
Bye.
All right, Kevin from Southgate, Michigan, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Steve, it's a blessing to talk to you again. I've been playing guitar since I was 13. I'm 71, anyway, I really appreciate what you said to that guy regarding Christian music versus, for us in our age, folk with Cats in the Cradle. I played Until That Final Day this morning for the boys, and there's about 13 of us. There was a guy there. It was the second time. We meet 6:30 Tuesdays in Wyandotte. And after he mentioned that in Matthew it said that if you do not forget your brother whom you can see, how can God forgive you and whom you cannot see? And, you know, after he came up to me, and because I disagreed with it, of course, and I said to him, I said, well, that's Old Testament, and that the four Gospels are really law books. And even though the Bible says the New Testament, the New Covenant did not go in effect until Christ's death. And I said that, you know, if righteousness come by the law, Christ died needlessly. And I kind of was close to him. He said, you're shouting at me. And so I started walking away. And the guy that heads up the group I've known since for 56 years, since I was 15. And he called me and said, you know, you really offended him. And, I said, well, I maybe so. And I said that he said, I think you should call him and apologize because he's a sensitive guy. And, his two daughters reject him. So I did. I called him, left him a message. And then Dave said, well, you know, another time you said something derogatory about LGBTQ. And this guy who they call him Lieutenant Sean, he's responsible for us meeting at Salvation Army. His daughter is a lesbian, and you offended him and another friend,
okay.
Keith Hillman.
So, Kevin, what can I do for you? What can I do for you?
Well, but I'm just wondering, like that last caller, I understand about rejection, but what your opinion is as far as, I believe that the book of Acts is really the beginning of the New Testament.
Okay, well, what you're sharing is a what's called a dispensational position, that you know that what Jesus taught isn't really for the present dispensation, that he, because his ministry occurred under the old covenant and he didn't inaugurate the new covenant until he was in the upper room. Therefore, the teachings of Jesus are not intended for our age, for the church age. There is truth in the fact that Jesus lived his entire life under the era of the Old Covenant, and that the New Covenant really didn't get established until the upper room when he took the Last Supper and said, this cup is the New Covenant, my blood. That part is true. But to derive from that the idea that what Jesus was teaching during his lifetime falls under Old Covenant authority rather than New Testament authority is, I think, not a possible conclusion to correctly draw, because it was after Jesus died and rose again that he gave the Great Commission in Matthew 28:19 through 20, and said that we should make disciples and teach them to observe all things that Jesus commanded. Now, this is at the end of his earthly life. He'd spent 3 years teaching and commanding his disciples, and now he's died and risen again. He's about to go to heaven, and he tells the disciples, when you make disciples, teach them to obey the things I commanded you. So that would suggest that the things Jesus taught are the things that Christian disciples are supposed to be taught to do. In other words, the teachings of Jesus were not actually the law of Moses. You're right in saying that the law of Moses is not applicable to the Christian as it was to people under the Old Covenant. But Jesus, although the New Covenant wasn't fully established with the disciples until the upper room, Jesus was breaking into the world with the New Covenant principles, the New Covenant phenomena. And therefore, his ministry kind of overlapped the end of the Old Covenant and the beginning of the New in terms of, you know, what God's mind is and what God's desire is for people to follow Jesus. Now, when Jesus taught the the Sermon on the Mount, for example. He wasn't teaching the Mosaic Law, although he made allusions to it. He told his listeners, you've heard that it was said, and then he quotes something usually from the Mosaic Law. But then he say, but I say to you, which would suggest that he's going beyond that. He's not simply affirming the law. He's going beyond that and teaching things that go beyond the law, which is what I think the New Testament throughout teaches. Now, your friend said that, you know, that if you don't forgive your brother whom you've seen, how can you love God whom you've not seen? That was confusing two passages of Scripture. It is true that Jesus said, if you don't forgive your brother his trespasses, neither will your heavenly Father forgive you your trespasses. It's a different passage, and this is in 1 John, which was, of course, well after Pentecost, when in 1 John chapter 4, verse 20 through 21, it says, if someone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. Now see, forgiving your brother and loving your brother are not two different things. If you love somebody, you are generous toward them. You're gracious toward them. You forgive them. That's simply a manifestation of love. That's the love of God toward us that we seek, is that he would also be gracious toward us and forgive us and so forth. So it is true that Jesus said that we have to forgive our brothers and that it's not optional. And it is true that that was before Jesus inaugurated the new covenant per se. But even after, well into the new covenant era, and this is probably near the end of the first century, John wrote 1 John, and he basically said the same thing. God commands us, if we love him, to love our brother too. And it's he who said, if you don't love your brother whom you've seen, how can you love a God whom you've not seen? So I think maybe you're putting the puzzle pieces together in a different way than that, especially with the new and the old covenant. I don't believe Jesus taught obedience to the Mosaic law per se as the continuing order. He did say that until it's all fulfilled, the law would remain intact, but he was above it. For example, Jesus said he was the Lord of the Sabbath. The Sabbath was not the Lord of him, and he could do whatever he felt was right on the Sabbath, which not everyone was allowed to do. Jesus could touch a leper. Jesus could touch a woman with an issue of blood. He could touch a dead body. In the Old Covenant, that wasn't permitted. It would make you unclean, but Jesus did it anyway. So we can see Jesus was living kind of above the standards of the Old Covenant. He said it's not what goes into your mouth that defiles you. It's what comes out of your mouth. Now, that was very contrary to the dietary laws of the Old Covenant. So Jesus, although he lived technically in the era at the end of the Old Covenant order, he was introducing and breaking into that time the new covenant principles. And I think that when he told us we have to forgive our brother, likewise, that was a New Testament principle, not an Old Testament one. Actually, the Old Testament doesn't command anyone to forgive their brother, but Jesus did at least three different times in his ministry. He indicated that we have to forgive our brother. And then, of course, Paul, who everyone agrees was a New Testament guy, New Covenant guy, Paul also told us we have to forgive on many occasions. So I think maybe the man who is affirming that you need to forgive people was maybe closer to correct in terms of the New Testament teaching than you were in that situation. Now, if you said something about LGBT that offended somebody who had a gay daughter or something like that, yeah, I mean, there are times when what Christians believe and say will offend unbelievers. And sometimes it may be just the information we're saying. They just can't stomach it. But it is possible that we might say things in an antagonistic way or what's clearly an unsympathetic way. For example, if someone was asking me about the LGBT, you know, thing, I would have to say, well, that whole mentality that there are many, you know, diverse sexualities and sexual behaviors is not what the Bible teaches. That's contrary to what Jesus taught. That's contrary to what the Bible has always taught. I would say that, but I would not be unsympathetic toward those who are struggling with those things, because people who are in the LGBT, we have to assume that, like other sinners, they're in bondage to their sin. I mean, people are in bondage to sin until they're set free. And the attitude we should have toward people who are in bondage is compassion and a measure of sympathy. We to get them out of bondage, we have to let them know the truth, because it's the truth that'll make you free. So we have to learn, as Paul said, to speak within love. Now, it may be that you did that and someone got offended anyway. That often happens. But if you did speak the truth but without love, it may be that that's one of the things that added to the offense. One thing is, I think we need to always be very self-critical when we find that somebody has been offended by what we've said. And we need to be very honest about the fact that, well, sometimes we are not as loving as we should be. Sometimes the way we say things isn't that palatable to somebody who disagrees. And it's very important for us to make the truth palatable, to make the truth, to adorn the truth, to make the truth attractive to the degree that we can. Many times the truths we have to speak will not be popular and will get us into trouble with people who don't agree with them, but we should make very sure that if people are angry at us, it's because they didn't like the truth we told. It's not that they didn't like us because we were being rude, seemingly overly, you know, critical, unsympathetic. Jesus was a friend of sinners, and I think the more we are seen as friends of sinners, the more the sinners will hear us gladly. Like it says that about Jesus, that the common people heard him gladly. The idea is not just that they hear us, but they'll hear us gladly. And the best way to do that is to be like Jesus, because the sinners did hear him gladly. It's the religious people that didn't like what he had to say and killed him. Listen, I need to take a break. I'm sorry about the conflicts you're having, but you may have to go back and apologize to someone. You just have to pray about that and be honest with yourself. We have another half hour coming up, but we have to take a break here. The Narrow Path is listener supported. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website's thenarrowpath.com.
As you know, the Narrow Path radio show is Bible radio that has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. So do the right thing and share what you know with your family and friends. Tell them to tune in to The Narrow Path on this radio station or go to thenarrowpath.com, where they will find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the radio shows. You know listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share what you know.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, feel free to call. We'll talk about it. If you see things differently than the host, well, feel free to call about that too. We can talk. I'd be glad to. The number to call is 844-484-5737. If you call right now, there is a line open. The number is 844-484-5737. And our next caller is Sam, calling from Los Angeles. Sam, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Appreciate it. I got a couple questions. I'm preaching through the book of 1 John, and I have to say, what a difficult book. John seems repetitive in a lot of things that he says, and it's just a challenge. But in chapter 5, I know there's at least a couple of verses that were not in the original text. And so my question is specifically about verse 6. If I'm preaching or teaching through that verse, let's say preaching on a Sunday morning, how do I, you know, in your opinion, how do I deal with that? How do I address that as I'm preaching to a congregation on Sunday morning, or the other verse as well that is not in the original text? And I'll take the answer offline.
Okay, thanks for your call. Well, you're right. There is a verse in 1 John chapter 5 that's not in the oldest manuscripts and therefore probably not in the original, and that is verse 7, which is the great Trinitarian verse, for there are three that bear witness in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Spirit, and these three are one. I could wish that verse 6 was also not in the older text, because it's one of the most perplexing verses in the Bible, to my mind. And it obviously meant something to the early readers, because they had a frame of reference that is not entirely the same as ours. They lived in a different world, a different time. They'd had access to the teachings of the apostles in their churches. We don't. And therefore, they would understand many things that could be alluded to by the writer in his letter to them that we wouldn't understand. And this is one of them. John 5, 6, it'd be nice if we could just say, well, folks, this is a difficult verse here, but fortunately it's not in the oldest manuscripts, so we'll just pass by it. Well, unfortunately, this one is in the oldest manuscripts, unlike the following verse, and it's very, very difficult. He says, this is he who came by water and blood, Jesus Christ, not only by water, but by water and blood, and it is the Spirit who bears witness, because the Spirit is truth. And then, in verse 8, skipping over verse 7, it says, and there are three that bear witness in earth, the Spirit and the water and the blood, and these three agree in one. Well, obviously what John is suggesting is we have three witnesses, the Spirit, the water, and the blood. In the mouth of two or more witnesses, every word is established, and that's the principle he has in mind. We have witnesses, that verify our beliefs, and these are them. Now, certainly that's not all there are. There's other witnesses. Even John, in his gospel, records Jesus listing a number of witnesses. So he said the Father bears witness, and John the Baptist bore witness, and the works that Jesus did bore witness, and the Scriptures bear witness, he said in John 5. But here, he lists other witnesses, the Spirit, the water, and the blood. Now, the problem is knowing what in the world he's talking about. Now, to say the Spirit bears witness is not a hard thing. Jesus actually said in John, I think in chapter 15 or 16, he told the disciples that, you'll bear witness of me, and the Holy Spirit will bear witness of me too. So we can know that that's a fact, though it's not clear how he includes that with the water and the blood. And the thing that's most difficult is to know what in the world he means by the water and the blood. Now, there's several theories about this. I don't know which one is true. I don't think anyone knows which one is true. This is obviously written to people who had the benefit of personal ministry of the apostles in their churches teaching on some of these subjects, which we don't have any teaching on them in their letters, at least not enough to make certainty about it. Some people think that the witness of the Spirit and the water and the blood refers to something that's kind of coming against the Gnostic ideas of the time, that the Christ came upon Jesus. Jesus was not the Christ, but the Christ was some kind of essence that came upon him at his baptism, and then and left him at his crucifixion when he died. And some people think the reference to the water and the blood here is somehow connected to the baptism of Jesus and his death, his on the cross, the blood. And that in some sense, what John is saying is that Christ didn't become the Christ at his baptism and cease to be the Christ at his death, as the Gnostics were saying, but rather he was the Christ through the whole period, through the water and through the blood, that is, through his baptism and through the crucifixion. This, to me, seems very, very difficult to swallow. I'm not saying it can't be true. I'm just saying it's not at all obvious to say that Jesus came by water and by blood. What does that mean, he came by water and by blood? Now, when he says it's the Spirit that bears witness, some people say, well, there's three times that God bore witness of Christ. Once was at his baptism when the voice from heaven spoke. That's the water. Then as he was approaching his death, God spoke from heaven in John chapter 12, and people heard the voice of God. Some said it thundered, but God testified to Christ there, and because that was generally around the time of his death. That's what John means by the blood, the time of his death. And the Spirit bearing witness would be what the Spirit does now, as Jesus predicted. To me, this explanation doesn't make much sense either. The truth is, I've read many attempts of people to make sense of this passage, and I'm talking about commentaries. I'm talking about scholars. I'm talking about respected guys. And most of them take a stab at it, but you can often tell when you're reading a commentary and he's grasping at straws. He's guessing. He's bluffing. I've always promised my listeners I'll never bluff. There are things I don't understand, and if I don't understand, I'm not going to bluff and say, well, I can fake this. I'll just tell you very honestly, I've never understood, and I'm not sure I ever will in this life understand what this verse is referring to. In my opinion, the original readers did and were expected to understand what he's referring to. But they had a frame of reference in their Christian experience and the teachings they'd received that, you know, kind of equipped them to set these words into certain pigeonholes, certain categories, and understand what John was saying. I believe that frame of reference has been lost to us. And while I believe the passage makes perfectly good sense to both John and his readers, I'm not sure anyone can make sense of it now. So what if you're preaching through 1 John? If I were preaching 1 John, I would, when I came to 1 John 5:6, I would say, this is a verse that I have never been able to make any sense of. And it's not for lack of trying. It's not for lack of thinking hard about it. I've thought hard about it. I've checked the commentaries. I've done my due diligence. I still don't know what it means, so it wouldn't make any sense for me to try to comment on it. I'll just read it, and we'll move on to something I can comment on. That's what I would do, but I'm not sure if that's your style or not. I will say also this, that the water and the blood, another suggestion, has come from John's Gospel in John chapter 19. John says that he witnessed when Jesus' side was pierced and the water and the blood came out. And he emphasizes, I bear witness to this. I saw that, as if that's a particularly important thing to bear witness about, that the water and the blood came out of the side. Now, most preachers will say the reason that that's important is the water coming out with the blood when his heart was pierced proves that his heart was really pierced and therefore he was really dead, because the water, there's a sac of clear liquid that surrounds the heart, and for that to be pierced as well as the heart would definitely make it impossible for someone to survive it, and therefore this is proof that Jesus didn't just swoon on the cross and then come back awake again in the tomb. The fact that it was witnessed by John that he'd seen the water and the blood come out, he emphasizes that in John 19, and that may be what he's referring to here. On the other hand, I'm not really sure why he would word it this way. If that's what he's talking about, you know, he came by water and blood. I mean, if I wanted to say he died and I saw the water and the blood and that proves it, then that's what I would say. But to say that Jesus came by water and blood and mean something like that is not the way I would say it. On the other hand, I'm not saying John has to talk like me, but I do have to either make sense of the way he said something or else say, I don't understand. Of course, I guess there's one other possibility that may come up, and that is that when Jesus told Zacchaeus that a man has to be born of water and the Spirit, many people think being born of water means baptized, but I personally believe that in John 3, when Jesus said you have to be born of water and the Spirit, John 3:5, that he's referring to natural birth. Water is natural birth, and the Spirit is spiritual birth. And if that's what John meant, if that's what Jesus meant, and if that's what John understood him to mean, then say that Jesus came by water and by blood, then coming by water could be like being born of the water, that is naturally born, and then blood meaning he was flesh and blood and proved it by his shedding his blood, and the Spirit bears witness. So, I mean, there's... what I've passed by you is a bunch of suggestions, none of which do I put my stamp of approval on, but all of them have been suggested, all of them possible. And we know that when John wrote this, his readers weren't in a position to say, well, I can think of three or four things this might mean, but I don't have a clue what it really means. Very obviously, John was not a poor communicator. He knew what his audience knew. and he knew what he could allude to, and it would make perfectly good sense to them. But he didn't know that we're going to be trying to figure this out 2,000 years later, and that we don't have that frame of reference yet. So I'm going to have to just say, if I were teaching through 1 John, coming to that verse, I'm going to have to say, listen, folks, I really don't know what this means. And that's the best I could do. I'm not sure if you could do better, maybe, but you ask my counsel. I that's the most I could hope to do. Let's talk to Darren from Federal Way, Washington. Darren, welcome.
Hi, Greg. My question is about you speaking to another guy in an earlier call about your brother. I'm wondering, who is your brother? What does that mean?
Oh, about forgive your brother?
Yeah.
Well, of course, there's the most narrow sense in the Bible is your brother is your fellow Christian. And it's not clear whether Jesus means that when he says your brother, since there wasn't really a Christian community yet to give context to brother in that sense. Jesus spoke to his disciples as if they are all brothers because they all have one father. And therefore he may have meant, you know, your brother disciple. On the other hand, they were all Jews and they were all in the, you know, the same Jewish community, the same Jewish society. And it's not unusual for people of the same race and religion to refer to each other as brothers in the more extended sense of, you know, like spiritual brothers or racial brothers. So he might have meant fellow Jews. Or, of course, he might have meant just any human being. In my opinion, the teaching of Jesus about relations with one another have special potence with reference to interaction between Christians. But the same principles would extend toward people outside the Christian community. And I get this, for example, from Paul's statement in Galatians 6:10, where Paul said, as much as you have opportunity, do good to all men, but especially those of the family of faith, the household of faith. In other words, there's a faith family of Christian brothers and sisters. And our of course, our highest obligation is to make sure we behave rightly toward them. But we should, in addition to that, be good as much as possible to everybody. So I think that we could say there's a hierarchy of importance. It's especially important that we treat our brothers, you know, properly. But that doesn't set us free to treat other people improperly. And, of course, treating them in this context probably has to do with, forgiving them. We should be willing to forgive people, whether they're brothers or not. Not because we're assessing their worthiness to be forgiven. Because whether someone's a Christian or not, they're not worthy to be forgiven. You don't have to forgive somebody if they haven't done something wrong. The very fact that forgiveness is needed means somebody has wronged you. And it hardly matters whether it's a Christian who wronged you or another person who wronged you. They don't deserve forgiveness. And that's just the point. You forgive them not because they deserve it, but in spite of the fact that they don't. That's called mercy. Forgiving is not justice, but forgiving is mercy. Now, a person who is merciful is simply that, merciful. In the Old Testament, it says that a merciful man is even good to his livestock, it says in Proverbs, even good to his animals. Not because animals have rights, but because he's a merciful man. A person who's naturally merciful is going to be seamlessly merciful. A man who will only be good or generous or forgiving towards someone because there's a command to do it. And he says, well, okay, do I have to forgive this guy? I don't really want to, but if I have to, I will. That's not being a merciful person. Christ wants you to be merciful by nature, in which case, of course, you're going to forgive your Christian brother, but you'll also be desirous to reconcile and be conciliatory toward non-Christians and even toward your animals. So, in other words, it's a character trait that manifests in all your dealings. You know, when Jesus was asked what the great commandment was, of course, he said, love your neighbor as you love yourself. And the lawyer who was asking the question, well, who's my neighbor? And it says the lawyer was trying to justify himself. He knew he didn't love everybody. So he is hoping, maybe if I have to love my neighbor, how narrowly can I define my neighbor? Because there are some people I love.
Right.
You know, is it okay if I call them my neighbors and the ones I don't love aren't my neighbors? So Jesus gave him the story of, we call it the Good Samaritan, where a Jewish man fell among thieves and was beaten and left for dead. Two Jewish religious people, a Levite and a priest, passed him by and didn't do anything for him. They were his brothers, so to speak, in the Jewish faith. And the guy who helped him was a Samaritan who was of a different race, a different religion, and a different country, which was hostile to his. The Jews and Samaritans were hostile. So here's a man who's about the least likely to be considered my neighbor. I mean, he might live in the province next door, but we're not friendly. You know, he's a different religion from me and all of that. And yet he helped the man. And Jesus at the end said to the lawyer, who do you think fulfilled the commandment to love his neighbor? Who was the neighbor? And the Pharisee had to say, I guess he who had mercy on him. And Jesus said, well, then go and do likewise. In other words, if you're supposed to love your neighbors yourself, then love your neighbor. Even your enemy is your neighbor. So, you know, when Jesus tells us to forgive our brothers and so forth, of course, there, in many respects, Jesus is describing the dynamics of the community of followers of Christ interacting in this way with each other. But the person who is like Christ is not just going to say, okay, my obligation to forgive ends at the perimeters of the church, you know. But the person who's like Christ is going to be the kind of person who wants to be merciful, who doesn't want to be unmerciful toward anybody. And therefore, if you love your neighbor, including your enemy, as Jesus said to do, then you won't be thinking, well, this guy's not a Christian, so I don't have to love him. But Paul did say, do good to all men, but especially those who are of the household of faith. So, I mean, obviously our priority is to show generosity and help and assistance to those who are part of the family of God, but everybody else outside too, as there's opportunity.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, Darren. Thanks for your call.
Yep. Yeah. Good day.
All right. Bye now. My computer's frozen, studio. Hey, bye now. I need the studio to hang up that call because my computer froze. And I'm not sure who's in the studio right now, but they're not doing it. Okay. I want to talk to Georgia in Beaverton, Oregon. But I need someone in the studio, if you're listening, to please activate her call. Now, it may be that the problem is in the studio, not with my computer. If that's the case, then we've got a problem here. Listen, this is a technical difficulty here, and I'm trying to put Georgia on. Georgia, if you're listening, we're doing what we can to activate your call. So if it's frozen in the studio, then that may be our problem. So we'll just, what shall I do? I will take a question that was written in, and we'll see if we can reconnect with Georgia in a moment here. So don't go away. I received a written in from Dave saying, how is Jesus different from Confucius, Buddha, and Muhammad? And we might say, in addition to that, from many other religious leader or founder. How is Jesus really different from them? Well, the main way, I mean, there's there's some significant ways that he's different, but one way is that he's not dead, and they are. And therefore, there is, in the case of Jesus, the possibility of actual interaction with him as a living being, as a living person. You can't have interaction with Confucius or Muhammad or Buddha or Krishna or any other, or a religious founder or mythical creature or a mythical god anywhere because none of them are alive. And Jesus is. And the whole point of Christianity is not just that Jesus started a new ethical system, which was, better than that of Buddha or Muhammad or Confucius or Socrates or anyone before him. In many respects, the ethical system that Jesus taught was very similar to some of these other religious founders. certainly is very similar to what Moses said in a lot of respects, and some of what Socrates taught and so forth. So the thing that makes Jesus distinct is not, strictly speaking, the ethical system that he taught, although it may have its own unique features, but more than that, it's that he's God in the flesh who still lives. He died for us, but he rose again, and he lives. So it's not simply, being a Christian isn't simply a matter of saying, I think the things Jesus taught are a lot better than the things that these other religious founders taught, so I'm going to be, I'll just go by what he says. Well, no, biblically, being a Christian is you surrender to Jesus as a real person. He's a living king. He died for our sins. He rose again. And as such, he is king at the right hand of God, and he has established a kingdom which we join by becoming his followers. Now, I mean, other differences exist between Jesus and other religious founders. Obviously, the one that most Christians would bring up would be Jesus is God. And they aren't. I mean, Jesus is, according to Scripture, God coming to live among us in a human form. That just doesn't, there's no other real claims like that in any other major religious system. And none of the people that are mentioned in the question ever claim such things about themselves. So I'm going to have to say there's very significant differences between Jesus and these other religious founders. One is that he's God, and they're not. Another is that he's alive, and they're not. Many other differences perhaps exist. We could say he was sinless, and they weren't, but we don't know enough about them to know how many times they sinned, but we just know they weren't sinless because they were human. So Jesus is different really in all the important ways from them. We have a friend named Michael who's a Buddhist who's been calling this show for years. And much of the time he has spent in his calls trying to prove to me that Buddhism is about the same as Christianity. And he's trying to build bridges there. He's a Buddhist, I'm a Christian. He's hoping for us to agree that we're kind of on the same page after all, because isn't Buddhism about the same as Christianity? Well, it is about the same, except in the most important defining elements, which makes it not the same at all. Because Buddha did not even necessarily believe there was a God. I mean, he wasn't emphatically atheistic, but his system didn't need a God. There was no affirmation of the existence of God in Buddhism. Whereas, of course, Christianity is all about God. It's all about God, who so loved the world that he sent his son to, redeem us and to save us. There's nothing like that in Buddhism. And everything else about Buddhism is different, too, especially karma and reincarnation and even many of the ethics, because Buddha left his wife and child, abandoned them, to go out and become a guru, or to go out to become a religious leader. Jesus never did that and never would have approved of that, because Christianity calls you to be faithful and loyal to your vows and to meet your responsibilities to your wife and your children and so forth. So are there differences between Jesus and these other people? There are a great number of differences of different kinds, but not all of them are equally important. The most important is, of course, who Jesus is compared to them. He is God come to live among us in the flesh. Neither Confucius, Buddha, Muhammad, or any other religious founder, certainly not Moses or the prophets, ever claimed that about themselves. And that is truly what makes Jesus unique. And as far as for practical purposes, the difference between him and the others for us is that if you want to follow one of the others, you're just following the teachings of a person who had some opinions and lived and died. Christ also shared what one might consider his opinions, but more importantly, he lived and died and then rose again, and that he's alive today. I'm sorry we couldn't take George's call. What actually happened is in our studio, apparently the computer crashed because I was not able to reconnect with it, and I was not able to put on the call. Apparently they weren't either in the studio. I'm not doing this from the studio. I do this program from my home. Like many people, I'm working remotely, and I'm connected to the studio by internet. But when things go down in the studio, there's not much I can do. But I hope that I hope that Georgia will call tomorrow and we'll try to get to her question then. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. All the resources there are free. You can donate if you want. Thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.